Good morning, everybody, and many thanks to Mark, Maxime, and Isabel for those very warm words of welcome. I'll have to apologize straight away that Brexit makes it even more unforgivable that British people can't engage in proper cosmopolitan communication with their imperialist language that leaves them able to be lazy. So my apologies for that, but I will carry on in English. The conference is very welcome, I think, in particular. Cultural studies always seems to be at some kind of threshold, conjuncture or other, where one wonders, what is it and where is it going? And I think with the passing of Stuart Hall, at a time of the intensification of neoliberalism and corporate capitalism generally, if there was one winner in the Brexit campaign on either side, it was the power of corporate capital, because no politics seems to be in any way viable unless it seems to go along with the interests of finance capital. An extraordinary proposition, even compared with 30 years ago. So the question of Marxism has never been sharper, funnily enough, because in the 80s and 90s, most cultural studies people, including Stuart Hall himself, seemed to be almost on the verge of not really being Marxist at all. But I think that the question of Marxism is now clearly more sharper now than it was in the 80s and 90s. And to me, that's a good thing, because I've always been, as Marx said, some kind of Marxist. And I think the very very general punchline of my talk today is that so was Stuart Hall. Some kind of Marxist, never quite completely post-Marxist, and I'll explain why this apparently rather banal generalization actually helps us resituate Stuart's work, and therefore, with the passing of Stuart Hall, poses even more sharply the question of, is there a cultural studies without some kind of Marxism? You can certainly have critical cultural studies of all kinds, but what is it that binds those critical perspectives in some paradigmatic unity, even at a very high level? And so indirectly, I'm posing that question, and I'm certainly hoping to learn a lot from my fellow speakers over the course of these next 2 days to educate me about how I might regard a quasi non-post Marxist view of critical cultural studies. The other thing that I have to confess that although I was at the Birmingham Cultural Studies Centre for many years and I worked with Stuart Hall for many years, I have never really felt completely in the inner circle of cultural studies or even really part of the cultural studies network. I kind of gravitated, as Mark explained, I kind of gravitated towards critical sociology, and I saw strengths in sociology that I felt were often rubbished too easily by the cultural studies in crowd. So I've always found it interesting to touch base with my feelings about cultural studies and its rather internalist form of discourse. Part of this problem, of course, is Stuart Hall himself, a uniquely canonical figure, such that it's hard to think of any other intrinsic leader of cultural studies than Stuart Hall. When you discuss the classics of cultural studies, and certainly in Britain, the names of Raymond Williams and E.P. Thompson come up, but they didn't see themselves as cultural studies leaders at all. In fact, in some ways, certainly Thompson was very critical of cultural studies. So Stuart Hall is the canonical figure. And so whenever you get discussions about what's theory, why is theory important, how can we develop good theory to intervene in the practical world? Of course. But just good theory itself. Somehow, cultural studies occasionally doesn't even come across as wanting to ask that question, whereas I always want to ask that question, and I find in critical sociology and sociological and cultural theory slightly outside the cultural studies corpus, one is allowed to just ask those rather simple intellectual questions. So what I'm going to try to do in this talk is resituate Stuart and his Marxism, question mark, with just bringing in a few references to people, thinkers, ideas that are not traditionally part of the cultural studies in-house vocabulary. At least I think, insofar, correct me if I'm wrong. And I think that it throws light on Stuart's Marxism to just come at it at a slightly lateral angle by talking a little bit about what kind of intellectual he was, what sort of theory he engaged in. In the cultural studies in crowd, there's a sense in which whatever Stuart did, it must have been a new kind of distinctive theory. And so even when Stuart is pitched as a conjunctural interventionist academic intellectual, that's taken to be a special kind of theory. And I'm not convinced that that's the case, or at least I think it's worth looking into with some rigor. And the overall thread that I'll be proposing is that Stuart didn't have, as some cultural studies commentators insist, he had a special independent theory of articulation, the way in which the cultural and non-cultural, the epistemological and the ontological, the subjective, the psychoanalytic, and the material all sort of somehow speak to each other. I think they do articulate with each other, but that's not exactly a theory. That's just the problem situation that anybody trying to explain anything has to face. But where Stuart, I think, is very definitely unique, and he is theoretical, I'm not saying he's not theoretical, but his theory is of a more intellectually mediational kind. I'll explain what that means. Several terms that I'm going to mention appear to be somewhat bland: mediator, moderator, but I'll try to convey that there's actually fresh insight to be produced with these kinds of terms. So I'm going to start by drawing on Zygmunt Bauman's distinction between different types of intellectuals. There are many schemas of intellectuals. We probably know this. There's Foucault's universal and particular intellectual. There's Gramsci's organic and traditional, and so on and so on. And by the way, I should put in a strong caution here, because although some of the categories I'll be explaining do have feminist exemplars, one might think of Spivak or Nancy Fraser or something like that, I'm aware that the whole business of theorizing intellectuals and producing typologies of intellectuals could be seen as a bit of a boy's game. It's something the men do to give themselves a certain kind of elevated status. I'll park that for now and get on with it. But I am aware that this is an important question that feminists traditionally pose, quite rightly. So let's look at Bauman. Bauman made this distinction between legislators and interpreters. Legislators were the modernist, controlling, naming the world, oracular, defining theorists, the ones that shifted our fundamental paradigms of understanding and were linked to episodes of various kinds of social engineering, as against and succeeded by the postmodern interpreter, much more dialogical, conversational, pluralistic, to the point where nothing is really believed as such, because all propositions, theories, controlling impulses are put under erasure. Those were Bauman's two categories. Heuristically, extremely useful. Not correct, because he posed them in a historical sequence that I think is manifestly not true. Legislators, modernity, interpreters, postmodernity. And not completely adequate, because there's a middle category, I think, and that's the category of the mediator. And I want to suggest that Stuart Hall's modus operandi is very much that of the mediator, pitched somewhere between, but never letting go of the oscillation or synthesis of the legislator and the interpreter. Now, this might look like heresy to some cultural studies people, because you find in the literature around Stuart the notion that if we return, for example, to his reading, this was 1973, first published, the reading of Marx's introduction in 1857 to the Grundrisse manuscripts, then you find a specific theory in Stuart Hall that is either or both a distinctive interpretation of what Marx was doing, and secondly, out of that reading and engagement with Marx, Stuart Hall produces something like the method of cultural studies. And this is why this is often discussed either as a theory of articulation in general, or as a position that is radically contextualist theorizing, or radical conjuncturalist theorizing. Now, I haven't got time to do this now. If we were to break up into small groups for 3 hours, I would hope to persuade you that what I'm just going to assert can be most conclusively demonstrated, but we're not going to do that now. What I will say is that actually, although people tend to look back and see Stuart's reading of Marx in that 1973 essay as almost the pinnacle of his own manifest independent theoretical construction, I think it's exactly what he told us it was. A messy reading produced in and for and with the cultural studies theory group, just trying to kick around some ideas about Hegel, Marx, cultural studies, and so on. It's very much a working paper. There's nothing more polished or conclusive to be gleaned from it. Now, that seems quite harsh, but there are at least two major areas about the 1857, the reading of the 1857 introduction, that are highly problematical. First of all, I'm hoping you're a bit familiar with the 1857 introduction by Marx as well as Stuart's work. So you'll remember that there's a whole episode, the first major phase of Marx's essay talks about the way in which production, consumption, distribution, exchange intermediate each other. Sometimes in the form of an immediate identity. Consumption is production, production is consumption. And then in various ways in which those four nodes mediate each other. They're the goals of each other, they form part of a differentiated unity, and so on and so forth. Now, Stuart knows that, and he can see that, but he actually argues that what Marx is trying to do is critique Hegel's naively identitarian understanding of the relationship between production, consumption, distribution, and exchange. And actually, Hegel does nothing of the sort. Hegel critiques exactly those philosophers, and I think he has Spinoza in mind, but he doesn't actually say in Hegel's Logic, he doesn't say it, but I think he has Spinoza in mind, whereby apparent opposites form part of a monistically fused conceptual ontology. So, in fact, what Stuart says is Marx's great achievement in that canonical writing is in Hegel. All the great phrases that we think are Marx's and that cultural studies people think are Stuart's, the movement from abstraction to the concrete as the product of a rich totality of multiple determinations, the synthetic unity of diversity in identity, all these phrases are straight out of Hegel's logic. And one of the problems with the text in Marx is that I think Marx kind of ultimately gives up on trying to wrestle a position of his own that's different from Hegel's, apart from a very arbitrary decision on Marx's part that production in this cycle is the key point. It's rather arbitrarily decided, in fact. So don't get me wrong, I'm not knocking Stuart's brilliant essay, and we all learned heaps from it. But it doesn't produce what cultural studies people tend to derive from it, namely a theory of articulation or a particularly historicized epistemology. Marx never actually tells us how we get from the false abstraction of general categories like population to something much more determinate and specific and concrete. He never tells us how we do that. He just sort of assumes that that's what good stuff does. And also, we've forgotten that by determinations, a rich totality of multiple determinations, there's a Hegelian aspect in that as well, because for Hegel and for Marx of that era, not the later Marx, the question of determination is not a simple causal material one. X is the determining condition of Y. It's more of a kind of constitutive conceptual strategy. One has to say, here's what a revolution means. Here's what a social revolution means. We would expect a social revolution to have certain kinds of determinations in it. Peasant revolt, rise of an urban bourgeois class, and so on. So for Hegel and for Marx, there's a conceptually specifying element of determination that we've forgotten about, and that Stuart forgot about. So this is just one rather scholastic way of trying to insist that Stuart didn't really operate, and he always told us he didn't operate well at the level of independent theoretical construction. And so it's part of my proposition that he never left and never could leave Marx and Marxism behind. And so what he's really doing is just helping us think of what Marx is doing in that very complex and actually completely unresolved text, which is why he gave it up, as a matter of fact, Marx. Okay, so let me return then. That would be my argument against anyone from within cultural studies who wants to say, but look at the reading of the 1857 introduction. That's Hall. It's all Hall. None of it's Marx. None of it's Hegel. I think that's mistaken. So let's think more about this category of mediator, because it sounds a bit boring. Sounds a bit bland. Sounds what you do when you want to bring different partners in a relationship together and it just won't work anyway, so you're wasting your time. Mediation. But mediation is an interesting category if you push it a little bit more deeply, and here I want to just very eclectically draw on some strands of thought from outside the Marxist and cultural studies traditions to try and upgrade this category of the mediator. Bruno Latour, not normally counted on the Marxism side of social analysis, But I think Bruno Latour is an extremely interesting, fertile thinker, and we can draw on his insights for any purpose we like. He makes a distinction between mediators and intermediaries. Intermediaries, and he's talking about things, circuits of material entities, but I'm just pretending that he's talking about mediators as people. Intermediaries are the sort of phenomenon and people who merely reflect, reproduce something given in the structure of society, a pre-existing, relatively stable underbelly of social structure. Intermediaries reflect that. Mediators for Latour are different. He says it's sometimes just a hair's breadth difference. And you think, well, what does that mean? But he says that if you look closely, mediators transform, translate, rearticulate, repose the stuff that we think they reflect. And the stuff that we think they reflect are not social structures, they're controversies. Basic kind of issues and movements and ways of being that will never come to an unproblematic synthetic unity. They just get reposed and reconstituted through the work of dynamic mediators. Now, I think you can look at Stuart Hall this way, because Stuart never actually resolves or leaves behind or transcends basic things like the culture and society couplet that he inherited from Raymond Williams and never lets go of, actually. Or the basic Marxist paradigmatic problem of the work of the determining structures and the relative autonomy of the cultural superstructures. These are kind of problems, controversies, issues that Stuart's sort of quite happy never to quite stabilize. They define his problem field, and in his own brilliant work of rearticulating, this is where articulation is important, rearticulating these given problems, somehow we're taken on to a more productive space. That's the work of a great mediator. I should be looking at time, good, shouldn't you're I? How long have I got?
Half an hour.
Good, okay. So I'll just mention one or two other possible leads that will upgrade this notion of the mediator. The sociologist, the American sociologist Mark Granovetter, as early as 1973, produced the beginnings of a sophisticated network theory called the strength of weak ties. And he identified as a crucial way of getting from micro-sociology to macro-sociology is the work of what he called people who are bridges, people who somehow take the detail of their own context and make it larger in social and cultural space. And I think this is a brilliant way of looking at Stuart Hall again. If you think of all the different audiences, constituencies, subcultures who regarded Stuart as wonderful, animating, central to their own self-conceptions, you know, the range of groups is incredible. Not just academic sociologists or activist cultural studies people, but community educators, literacy educators, black metropolitan artists of an avant-garde type. The range of people who see Stuart as theirs, that's our Stuart, they would say. Stuart would laugh and they'd all say, oh, great, that's our Stuart. We all did it. This was part of his incredible power of interpolation. We all thought, that's our Stuart. We are hailed. But the diversity of intellectual and practical communities who held this is extraordinary. The Open University itself, you might not know very much about it in France, was a quite remarkable social democratic experiment that reached hundreds of thousands of ordinary people drawn into courses about crime, popular culture, and so on. And Stuart would go out to meetings and tutorial groups throughout the UK to talk to these people, and they came away singing in their heads, "That guy, Stuart, wow." And the funny thing about Granovetter's theory is that it's the strength of weak ties that makes this bridge that takes a micro-sociological subculture into bigger public relevance. And the weak tie just means that Stuart didn't actually belong to any one of those communities decisively. He was a kind of part of all and none. And that's the hallmark of a great mediator. One last example from a literature that's got nothing to do really with cultural studies or Marxism, namely the sociology of science. There's a guy called Harry Collins, very fine sociologist of science, and he has given us what he humbly calls a new periodic table of expertise. It's a modest character. And he identifies basically two kinds of experts. One is the contributory propositional expert, and he's thinking mainly of scientists, actually, you know, the definers of subatomic particle theory or something like that. But it stretches to anything you want it to stretch to. And then interactional experts. This is my mediator. Interactional experts are still experts. They're not just filters or funnels. There's work there. There's intellectual work to be done. And the work that's to be done, the expertise in question, is a knowledge, a profound tacit knowledge, not an explicit knowledge, but a tacit form of knowledge of the particular culture of debate and discovery that we're talking about. And a profoundly personal, we mustn't, you know, I'm not, by doing all this stuff about mediator categories, I'm not for one minute saying that Stuart just wasn't, I mean, he was just a brilliant individual with a radiant personality. But we still have to sort of theorize it somewhat. And this is the way I theorize it in Collins's terms. Stuart was an interactional expert, working through tacit knowledge, profound understanding of the enculturation of particular debates and issues. And Collins argues, in science and society generally, these communicative, interactional experts are more and more important. And I think that's why Stuart did become actually more important as his life went along, from days when only 3.5 people knew him at Birmingham. Okay, so I'm trying to persuade you that this concept of the mediator can be interestingly illuminated by references to non-Marxist and non-cultural studies theorists, and that it applies to Stuart Hall. I've actually got another section that I'll skip, which is about rhetoric, because Stuart was a profoundly persuasive and charismatic speaker, not all the time, as I'll come to say. So we need to know about what is the rhetorical mechanics of being a great mediator. But I haven't got time to go into that. I draw there, again, on someone who hardly anybody knows, and that's Rika Edmondson, who wrote a great book in 1984 called Rhetoric in Sociology. Okay, so I'm trying to persuade you that mediator is a perfectly good, indeed inspired category, not a dumbing-down category to use of someone as great as Stuart Hall. And now I need to tell you why that's related to what I see as his baseline Marxism. First of all, why do we want to rescue his Marxism? Here, I think we just need the briefest of panoramas on the intellectual critical scene, because I think that we've reached a point where a whole spate of critiques of critique, very powerful critiques of critique, went on, especially during the 1990s, and they've now kind of run their course. I mentioned Latour. Latour's critique of sociologists of the social, that's people who think that there's this thing called society that determines anything else, and he says that that's a sociology and cultural studies have a kind of little internal war, but Latour says they all still inhabit the society culture upward arrow configuration in order to pinpoint, situate, analyze how particular cultural forms came to be. But then the second part of the two-step is the progressive method. And here, I don't know if it's the same in France, it probably is, but in the UK, there's quite a big fan club for vitalist or neo-vitalist modes of understanding. And I think Sartre provides just exactly where that comes in a way that Stuart Hall would appreciate. Because for Sartre, even if we are all thoroughly situated and can only be explained in our being by the categories of historical materialism, etc., Marxism generally, nevertheless, what we choose to do, which will be predictable, which will be understandable, is never predictable, because we are always faced in our actions in the present with a range of possibles, only some of which can be realized. And we can't determine which ones will be realized. Because, says Sartre, the progressive moment of culture, politics, subjectivity is constantly to orientate ourselves towards a different future. This is what he calls the project. And the project is orientated to possibility. He's got a couple of lovely neo-vitalist phrases, especially he says, this is about the profundity of the lived. Now, it's interesting that those kind of phrases, the profundity of lived, the lived, orientation towards possibility, those are the kinds of phrases that many post-Marxist theorists think spell the ruin of Marxism, the inadequacy of Marxism. But Sartre doesn't think that. And I actually think his progressive way of talking about methodology and understanding is better, for example, than talking about structure and culture, structuralism, culturalism, individual society. So I would recommend having another look at Jean-Paul Sartre, Question of Method, and I think this exactly captures the spirit of Stuart Hall. He never, ever says, we have no need for structural, historical, materialist, situational analysis of anything, because we can't determine where things came from, what their social logic is, without that Marxist background. But Marxism in and of itself just cannot tell us how to appreciate, never mind predict, where these profoundly lived history on the move experiments, movements, and aspirations are going to take us. And this was Stuart Hall's cultural studies. He did not want us to lose the explanatory anchors, but he did want us to be descriptively appreciative and to develop independent categories and sensibilities to grasp this history on the move. Good. Okay. Well, in 5 minutes, I can't now. See, what I need to do now, just to keep you persuaded of this, is go through the entire oeuvre of Stuart Hall's writings to tell you, to show you exactly what I'm saying is the right way to look at it. I should say, by the way, that I'm doing this partly because there's going to be a terrific series of collections of Hall's writings published by Duke University Press over the next several years, probably 6 or 7 volumes, and I'm meant to be editing and framing the volume on Stuart Hall and Marxism. So at some point, I'm going to have to bore whoever reads that with my run through the entire genre work of Stuart Hall to prove my point. But just very... here's what I would say in terms of the... You see, one of the things that always worried me about cultural studies insiders is that you could never criticize Stuart. And it was partly because I don't think we had the tools to do that, and also because he was so uniquely special. It seemed like a betrayal. But the way I'm looking at it, it allows you to say what the kind of good Hall and less good Hall really is in terms of these exercises in rhetorical and political mediation. Okay? And it allows us to look at the later work that seems to drift quite far away from Marxism, and it allows us to say that that's true. You know, there's no question. I mean, you know, he had a lot of trouble with am I a Marxist? Does it matter? What does post-colonialism do for Marxism? Does it involve a rejection or a disruption, etc.? He was very keen on Foucault and Derrida in little bits and pieces. I don't think he actually read Derrida, but that speaks to his credit, probably. Anyway, so I would rerun the whole production line in that kind of way. And it allows us to flag up, for example, 3 brilliant but currently undervalued essays of the 1970s. In fact, all in 1977. 3 classic Hall essays in 1977. It's almost like those 3 incredible albums by Bob Dylan in 1975, Desire and Blood on the Tracks and Street Legal. So 3 essays. One on class and class structure in a book that was the written up version of a marvelous conference where Poulantzas came over to London and Paul Hurst was at his brilliant best, deconstructing best, and that was one of Stuart's greatest ever performances, I think, and one of his best ever essays. Meticulous. When Stuart decides that he's really digging into some of these questions, he's a very meticulous scholar. Whereas, so that's one, there's another one, Base and Superstructure in Marxist Theory, and another one in a volume of cultural studies papers that I was the main editor for called On Ideology, called The Hinterland of Science, where he does an incredible scan through the sociology of knowledge, and again, always inclusively. He never rules anything out. This is the work of a mediator. How can you be inclusive to more or less everything and yet not look as if you're mushily infinitely pluralistic? It's a tremendous trick to pull. And it's only his commitment to Marxism, I think, that stops Stuart being the kind of pluralistic mediator who ultimately no one is ever going to listen to because there's no bottom line. I think that's my bottom line, is there has to be a bottom line. And for Stuart Hall, the bottom line was always a basic kind of Marxism. Because without that bottom line, you do become the Baumanian interpreter, listening to everybody, valuing everything, ultimately saying nothing. So how Stuart managed to weave his way between a low-level bottom line in Marxism, and it was a low level, but it never went away, and that's what enabled his mediational exercises, his inclusivity, his diagnostic generousness. That's what made that have ultimately some anchoring, the little bit of the legislator who's still in the mediator. So I would highlight those three essays of 1977. Beautiful articulations of both ends of the chain of Marxism, base culture, base and superstructure, culture and economy, against what has been a very celebrated essay by Hall, namely the Marxism Without Guarantees essay of 1983, where it seems to me he acknowledges what he calls the immense force of post-structuralist ideas to the point where he can't rescue anything of Marxism at all. It's meant to be Marxism Without Guarantees, but it almost says we don't really want any guarantees of anything. We just want to be sort of completely open to everything that's vaguely interesting. So he talks about we can't quite ever, all the time, give up on some aspect of Marxist categories, at least not in a religious way, and blah, blah, blah. And it goes on for pages and pages making these kind of qualifications. And ultimately you think, that's not the right balance between the baseline and the embracing of other positions. So I think that's, this is me being critical. I don't think that's one of his best essays at all. I'd recommend those other ones. Now, what I would do then, but I'm not going to, is I think it's very worthwhile looking at the key writings of the Thatcherism Hall, especially the middle chapters of The Hard Road to Renewal, called a theoretical section, where again there's some very interesting and strenuous, good combinations of a basic Marxism, although understated, and a pluralistic openness. And this is quite remarkable, and it shows you what nobility Hall had, because it's a response to a series of ruthless, brutal critiques by Bob Jessop, who said that Hall's analysis of Thatcherism was idealist, that he didn't even get the ideology of Thatcherism right, that Stuart had no real appreciation of the structural elements of the Thatcherite conjuncture, that he grotesquely exaggerated Thatcher's popularity amongst the British people because the figures don't show that, etc., etc. Very, very hard hitting. And Stuart comes back because he's primarily an inclusive mediator, and for whom commonality of discursive space on the left is more important than his ego, he comes back and says, do you know what? That's a very important critique. A very important critique. And he's saying that the critique is right in many ways. But he still, so he says that he wasn't arguing for ideologism, superstructuralism. He wasn't arguing that Thatcherism was all conquering, etc. He just wanted to bend the stick away from a kind of structural reductionism to saying culture, ideology, consciousness needs its own level of attention. So that's the kind of nobleness about Stuart that I don't think anybody else in that kind of tradition has had, because it involves a certain paradoxical modesty, the central canonical figure who's actually intellectually relatively modest and wants to do the work of inclusion to the best possible effect, even if it means accepting that I, Stuart, have been given a bit of a kicking here. Then I would look at... Nearly finished. Then I would look more controversially, perhaps, at Stuart's key post-colonial writings. The West and the Rest essay of 1992 and When Was the Post-Colonial essay of 1996. Both, I think, terrific pieces of work and much better than some of his other interviews on these questions. And this is where you see Stuart taking strong influence from Homi Bhabha, as well as, of course, Edward Said, and stretching the commitment to Marxism pretty much to the breaking point. But in both essays, towards Foucault in The West and the Rest, and towards Derrida in When Was the Postcolonial, he's being provocative. He poses the questions that Foucauldian regimes of truth breaks ideology analysis, and that Derridean deconstruction breaks any notion of a definitive reading, leaves us completely agonistic. He takes that to the brink, I think, but then he comes back. And finally, even in the very interesting, very challenging, one of his last great essays on the multicultural question, he says, the multicultural question, the way in which it challenges Eurocentric and including Marxist notions of progress, of class unity, of even explanatory competence, he says that this question outruns any of our current vocabularies of understanding and action. It almost puts them into the totally agonistic, I don't know what we're going to do about this. I don't even know how to think about this. But we mustn't take this question of multiculturalism with the usual culprits, with the usual suspect way of analyzing it. So a tremendously open-ended essay. But I would hope to show that there are one or two little places where the bottom lines fall back into place because he can't quite think outside this broad Sartrean horizontal Marxism that I've tried to recommend to you. Thank you very much.